As we passed one of the other cottages on our way to the school, I heard a shriek, followed by a wailing, picked up and echoed by two or three other voices. There were bars on the windows. Winslow looked uncomfortable for the first time that morning. "Special security cottage," he explained. "Emotionally disturbed retardates. When there's a chance they'll harm themselves or others, we put them in Cottage K. Locked up at all times." "Emotionally disturbed patients here? Don't they belong in psychiatric hospitals?" "Oh, sure," he said. "But it's a difficult thing to control. Some, the borderline emotionally disturbed, don't break down until after they've been here for a while. Others were committed by the courts, and we had no choice but to admit them, even though there's really no room for them. The real problem is that there's no room for anyone anywhere. Do you know how long our own waiting list is? 1,400. And we may have room for 25 or 30 of them by the end of the year."
"Where are those 1,400 now?"
"Home. On the outside, waiting for an opening here or in some other institution. You see, our space problem is not like the usual hospital overcrowding. Our patients usually come here to stay for the rest of their lives." As we arrived at the new school building, a one-story glass and concrete structure with large picture windows, I tried to imagine what it would be like walking through these corridors as a patient. I visualized myself in the middle of a line of men and boys waiting to enter a classroom. Perhaps I'd be one of those pushing another boy in a wheelchair, or guiding someone else by the hand, or cuddling a smaller boy in my arms. In one of the woodworking classrooms, where a group of older boys were making benches under a teacher's supervision, they clustered around us, eyeing me curiously. The teacher put down the saw and came towards us. "This is Mr. Gordon from Beekman University," said Winslow. "Wants to look over some of our patients. He's thinking of buying the place." The teacher laughed and waved at his pupils. "Well, if he buys it, he's got to take us with it. And he's got to get us some more wood to work with." As he showed me around the shop, I noticed how strangely quiet the boys were. They went on with their work of sanding or varnishing the newly finished benches, but they didn't talk. "These are my silent boys, you know," he said, as if he sensed my unspoken question. "Deaf mutes." "We have 106 of them here," explained Winslow, "as a special study sponsored by the federal government." What an incredible thing. How much less they had than other human beings. Mentally retarded, deaf, mute, and still eagerly sanding benches. One of the boys, who had been tightening a block of wood in a vise, stopped what he was doing, tapped Winslow on the arm, and pointed to the corner where a number of finished objects were drying on display shelves. The boy pointed to a lamp base on the second shelf, and then to himself. It was a poor job, unsteady, the patches of wood filler showing through, and the varnish heavy and uneven. Winslow and the teacher praised it enthusiastically, and the boy smiled proudly and looked at me, waiting for my praise, too. "Yes," I nodded, mouthing the words exaggeratedly. "Very good, very nice." I said it because he needed it, but I felt hollow. The boy smiled at me, and when we turned to leave, he came over and touched my arm as a way of saying goodbye. It choked me up, and I had a great deal of difficulty controlling my emotions until we were out in the corridor again.